The White Network presents Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. Your host, Carolyn Yeager.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining me on this Saturday, October 12th, 2013. Today is a somber day, as it always is when you're burying someone or something. Eric Priebke died yesterday at the age of 100. He is the SS veteran from World War II, German, who was convicted in Italy for what was done in as reprisal shootings. And he's been in the news quite a bit. He's had a lot of support. There are websites in his name and so on. But yesterday, and he's has an amazing constitution, but he reached the age of 100, and he though passed away yesterday. So all of his enemies don't have him to push around anymore. But I received an email this morning. I learned about it yesterday, but someone sent me, someone from Italy, an Italian comrade, sent me an email. So I'm just going to read it directly as he wrote it to me to tell you a little background on Captain Priebke. Captain Eric Priebke has left us, being very old, 100 years, and he left a personal testament, which will be made public later by his lawyer, a true comrade, I must say, his lawyer, Paolo Giacchini. I was present at a conference a month ago where this lawyer, together with some German men of this association, which is www.eric-priebke.com, talked about the iniquitous and deceiving, unjust juridical history of Eric Priebke's case. Eric Priebke is a former Gestapo, and at a later stage, by the end of World War II, an SS officer. He only did with the typical, at those times, German spirit, what were the orders of the Führer. The anti-fascist Italian government had betrayed its alliance and, helped by Jews and communists, turned against the Germans. And he says in a little town that he lived in, a traitor general ordered that civilians who would be killed on sight if they wouldn't fight against the Germans, and these people consider the Germans their allies. So that's what this person experienced. But he says, because of the frequent attacks that, Italians who turned against the Germans, and because of the frequent attacks against the Wehrmacht, every German soldier killed would have been followed by 10 executed Italians. Well, at that time, Germany was still occupying Italy, but there was a lot of resistance, and I think probably in the south it was the most. So they didn't have control of all of Italy at that time. Of course, the Italians had gotten rid of Mussolini, and so they were, you know, there was a lot of bad killings of German soldiers by these resistance and partisan type people. And so the Germans made a policy to, for every German soldier that was killed, they would execute 10 Italians. And as Priebke said, because this all fits in with what today's program is, so. As Priebke said many times, that was the praxis at those times. Now, praxis is a Greek word meaning the process. And it's the process by which an idea is realized, or, you know, is carried out, the carrying out phase of the whole idea. In ancient Greece, there are three types of knowledge: theoretical, to which the end goal was truth; poetical, I'm not sure what that is, if it's not poetical, it's poietical, to which the end goal was production; and practical, to which the end goal was action. So the praxis is simply, you know, then the process, the action part of the process, of the whole process of that which National Socialism and the Third Reich were all about, and for which so many Europeans joined in, you know, into trying to help bring about. So the email goes on, and then it is clear that the Nuremberg process was a Jew-driven farce, not to punish questionable praxis, which were carried out on by all armies, but only to destroy Germany and the National Socialists. And it is even clearer, as Priebke, one of the last witnesses of those times, always said, that the extermination camps and the gas chambers were a fraud. That was one of the things that he, of course, knew from his own experience as a part of that those German fighting forces. And he always said that, so that made him very unpopular. But he stuck to his guns to the end. My correspondent says Captain Priebke was sentenced illegally to life prison in 1998 in Rome, Italy, by a court which was totally driven by the will of the powerful Jewish community of Rome. He died yesterday after living as a true man, never compromising with the false, never retreating, never looking to escape his destiny. An authentic example of a National Socialist. Honor to Erich Priebke. I want to tell you that the, and you know, I say yes to that too. I want to tell you right now that the break music for today's program, which will be between the first and second hours, in case I forget to mention it, is Unknown Soldier by Annette Mueller. We just started it last week, I think, and or maybe the week before. But it's another German song. But if you want information about it, you can find it by going to the White Network and clicking on the program page for Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn, and you'll find that information and even the English translation of the song, of the words there. So today I'm going to what am I going to do today? I'm going to talk about the yes, of course I'm going to talk about the Matonio Graf Q's book. But before I do get started on that, I need to pick up my pace here too. I want to just mention something that was in, it was sent to me. So I said, I don't look at Tikkun Olam, which is a Jewish website. And but in this article there, they gave information on a poll that was taken in Israel by the Israel Democracy Institute, and they found that, which the Tikkun Olam don't agree with because they're very leftish, you know, type pro-Israeli people, not rightish type pro-Israeli people, but it found that the Israelis hold racist views and reject bedrock democratic principles, and they believe their country should be both Jewish and a democracy. See, they want to call it a democracy, even if it isn't a democracy, or they want a new kind of democracy. Well, I don't like democracy either, so I would have to go along with them on that. It says that just under 50%, actually, a better way to put it, is that among the younger Israelis, 65%, said that there should be a preference, that the Jews should be privileged people in Israel, they should there should be such a thing as Jewish privilege over non-Jews. And that it's about 49% of the all ages, but 65% of the younger Israelis. And 65% of all Israeli Jews believe that Jews are the chosen people, and they majority of those believe that non-Jews should have no role in determining major national policy choices. There you go. So, you know, for all their humanitarian spirit that they claim that they have, when they're the underdogs, when they're so concerned with being fair to everybody and all the minorities and not, you know, and allowing them into your country, they need, you know, allowing them to have the same opportunities you do and so on. For all of that, you know, when they have their own state, territory, that they want to protect and have for themselves, they change completely to wanting to preserve the racial purity, the racial makeup of the country, and they want their own political control there. They don't want to share it. And we should really not be against them for this. I'm not against them for this. I'm not calling out, oh, those racists, those horrible racist Jews in Israel. That only harms our own cause for what we want for ourselves. I've said this many times, and I do not understand how all these so-called pro-white people, or they're not even really pro-white, but they kind of, people think they are or something. They think they are. Attack Israel on this basis and are so against racism. So, we just have to remember what we want for ourselves and keep our mind on what we're doing. So today I'm going to talk about this book, The Extermination of the Action Reinhardt Extermination Camps, so-called, by Matonio Graf and Kues, which I talked about, last week. And I'm going to go into it more in a revisionist style today. And I'm going to, I've got chapter 5 here that I'm going to work through, but it's a long chapter. It's about 300 pages and it's just packed with stuff. So there's no way. I mean, I'm going to try to, as I'm going along with it, because I'm going to, read it on the PDF. I'm not just going to read it, folks. Don't worry. But I'm going to use the PDF as it is because it doesn't copy well at all. And I have to keep changing all the line lengths and everything. So it's a pain and to take out the parts I want. So I can't, you know, make any markings or anything on the PDF. So, but that's what I'm going to use when I get to it. But I've got a few things to deal with first. Now, I said it's a long chapter. Did I say it was about 300 pages? Did I say that? It starts at page 174. It's called The Fuhrer Order and the Alleged NS Extermination Policy. And it's written by Carlo Matonio. And it has 9 sections in it. Starts on page 174, ends somewhere around page 450, maybe not that far in, but between 440, 450, something like that. Maybe even a little more than that. but I've got some notes here on this page that I'm going to go through first before I do that. And some things that I thought were especially interesting that I did copy from there. And one thing is that the early reports of the German atrocities, of the German extermination, you know, against the Jews and so on, their policy. These reports came out in 1942, and the Fuhrer Order by most, there was no Fuhrer Order. They can't find a Fuhrer Order, but what they want to think that there was a Fuhrer Order, even though they can't find it, that in some way that it was sometime between summer 1941 and summer 1942. And then we had the reports of, because after that came the reports of all this stuff going on. And I'm taking this from Carlo Matonio from the chapter. I can't say exactly. I don't have the page number here in the beginning of it, but he writes, the surge in, I think this is him writing this, the surge in intensified anti-German propaganda had begun on 30th August 1942 when the Geneva office of the Jewish Agency for Palestine disseminated a report on National Socialist atrocities. Myron Taylor, President Roosevelt's personal representative to Pope Pius XII, then transmitted the report on September 26, this would have been 42, to the Cardinal Secretary of State, Luigi Maglione, inquiring whether the Vatican could confirm its contents. And some of the contents of the report are, one, liquidation of the Warsaw Ghetto is taking place. Without any distinction, all Jews, irrespective of age or sex, are being removed from the ghetto in groups and shot. Their corpses are utilized for making fats and their bones for the manufacture of fertilizer. Corpses are even being exhumed for these purposes. And Belzec is mentioned afterwards under point two. It reads, these mass executions take place not in Warsaw, but in especially prepared camps for the purpose, one of which is stated to be Belzec, which is misspelled at the beginning there. And then it goes on. In the month of July, the report continues, some 50,000 Jews were killed at Lemberg on the spot, while, according to another report, 100,000 have been massacred in Warsaw. This last part, according to another report, is from the report. There is not one Jew left in the entire district east of Poland, including Russia. Not one Jew left. It is also reported in this connection that the entire non-Jewish population of Sevastopol was murdered. Furthermore, the report relates that Jews deported from Germany, Belgium, Holland, France, and Slovakia. Now, this is Matonio now writing this. Furthermore, Jews deported from Germany, Belgium, Holland, France, and Slovakia are reported to have been sent to be butchered, though it does not specify where, and adds that a large part of the Jewish population deported to Lithuania and Lublin has already been executed. Finally, the report mentions Theresienstadt as an interim station for Jews awaiting, quote, the same fate, unquote, and emphasizes that, quote, arrangements are made for new deportations as soon as space is made by executions, with deportation transports being often seen, about 40 people in each cattle car. Naturally, in these reports, you know, there's never any proof of anything. They, you know, supposedly lots of people are seeing these deportation transports. The Vatican, for its part, Matonio says, responded that, quote, reports of severe measures taken against non-Aryans have also reached the Holy See from other sources, but up to the present time, it has not been possible to verify the accuracy thereof. In this intricate tangle of little truth and much propaganda, Matonio writes, it no doubt was difficult even for Goebbels, Dr. Joseph Goebbels, propaganda minister, to supply counter evidence, and a letter from Heinrich Himmler to the head of the Gestapo, Heinrich Müller, stated in November 1942, shows just how difficult it was, and I didn't go on and copy any more of that, but that's, this is something you'll find in, I think in the beginning, somewhere, oh well. Then I go to chapter four, a little thing here written by Jürgen Graf. It's on page 154. It starts on page 154. Noble Victor, Quest for Justice. It goes without, Groff writes, it goes without saying that Terry, this Nicholas Terry, will not touch this crucial question of witness credibility, even fleetingly, as their declarations are one of the two pillars upon which the extermination camp myth is based, the eyewitness testimony and confessions of perpetrators. I just took this down because I wanted to remember to mention that Groff is saying that the whole extermination camp myth is based on these two pillars of eyewitness testimony and the confessions of the Germans who were involved in these camps, guards and so on, who, as we know, some of them made confessions, and most of these confessions, or an awful lot of these confessions, just don't make any sense, or there's not much to them. But they were all imprisoned and forced to make some kind of confession in which they hoped they would maybe save their lives or be released even. But, of course, most of them were either hung, given a death sentence anyway, or were given very long prison sentences in gulags and so on. And Groff says that any doubts about the witness's reliability would shake the whole edifice of lies right down to its very foundation, which is why they hold on to these witness testimonies the way they do. Now, we know that these five bloggers, and I didn't point that out in the beginning of the program, but anyway, this book by Carlo Mantogno, Thomas Cuse, and Jürgen Graf is in response to a 540-page paper. Now they're calling it a paper. By these five Holocaust controversies bloggers, in which they intended to attack and put the findings of our revisionists in dispute with their paper, and so our revisionists thought they should answer it. But the point is that these bloggers are at the bottom of the heap of Holocaust revisionists, of Holocaust historians, and I was going to say hoaxers. I'm going to try to be careful in this program not to say too much that will make it more people who are not yet converted listen to it. So I don't want to call them too many names which would actually fit them, but what they're often called those who are trying to hold up the edifice of the Holocaust, what they write, a lot of them are historians, PhDs and so on, and they're given a good reputation, as I said last week, not that they necessarily deserve it at all, but these five guys don't have that even, and nobody really pays any attention to them, and yet they have brought forth all the arguments that the whole Holocaust industry brings forth. And, you know, they believe every witness testimony there is. And there are historians who, of course, doubt quite a few of them. But they always, explain them away or excuse them because they went through so much, you know, and they were confused. And there was a lot of rumors going around. So truth and reality and unreality got mixed up in their minds and all this stuff. But, you know, if you don't believe these witnesses, well, then there isn't anything to go by. That's what they're saying. There's no foundation for it. So going on to page 162, and the only reason this is Graf writing about the Demjanjuk trial of 1986 and 88. And I don't really think I need to go into that too much. The only purpose I had in this, if I can, was that I found it interesting that he said how the Soviet Union, still in existence at that time, knew very well that that Demjanjuk was not Ivan the Terrible. Here it is. They knew he was not Ivan the Terrible. But they didn't say anything, and they let him be accused of being Ivan the Terrible, who was actually Ivan Marchenko, not Ivan Demyanyuk. But he asked, you know, why did they not volunteer to hand this evidence that they had over to the Israeli authorities on their own? Rather, the files on this were unearthed by Demyanyuk's able Israeli attorney in the Russian archives. And, you know, for all the talk they go through about, you know, not how terrible it is to kill an innocent person, you know. Well, they knew that Demyanyuk was an innocent person, although they might not have thought of him as such since he was a guard working for the Germans. But that didn't make him guilty of, he wasn't at that camp, you know. He wasn't that guard working there. So, Jurgen answers this with the answer that's all, it is behind almost all of this, is that the Soviets benefited from the Demyanyuk trial for two reasons. Not only did it allow them to denigrate the Ukrainian exile community, which is strongly critical of the USSR, and as you should know, Demyanyuk was Ukrainian, and a lot of Ukrainians worked as guards in ghettos and camps and so on for the Germans once the Germans went into that country. And it also thwarted any possibility of an anti-Soviet alliance between Ukrainian exiles and Jews. So the Soviets were somehow feared an alliance between Ukrainian, anti-Soviet Ukrainian exiles and Jews to somehow, you know, help the Ukrainian freedom movement and so on and to free Ukraine from Soviet control. And so this was all political, is what is the point, you know. To the Soviet Union, their political interests were more important than any one man's life or even many men's lives. And political interests trump everything. And this whole, everything that's done in the world, all the awful things are for political reasons. And this whole Holocaust is being kept alive for political reasons. And it started with political reasons. And so political interests are way more important than what you do to human beings and even entire nations and countries and so on. So that was the point there. And this led Jurgen Graf into something that I think is interesting and I want to cover just to remind everyone about this. Page 167, he's talking about some trials that took place after the war, not at Nuremberg, after that. And he asked two questions. Why did the freest state in German history put many of its own citizens on trial for having participated in an imaginary slaughter? And two, everybody agrees that torture was not used in the Federal Republic of Germany, so why did the defendants in those trials not dispute the alleged mass gassings? Okay, these are things that come up that people will say, well, Germany put its own citizens on trial, so they must have thought they were guilty. And also, you know, why did these people accept the guilt for something if they didn't do it? All right, he says, as far as the first question is concerned, it is essential to remember that the Federal Republic, under its current constitution, is not now and never has been a sovereign country. Down to the present day, this state has always slavishly followed the American Zionist Party line. At no moment have its leaders seriously attempted to defend the national dignity and the national interests of their people. Well, I like the way that is put. You know, they do not defend the national dignity of their people or the national interests of the German people. And, you know, we know that. And he said, Groff says, indeed, even if they had desired to pursue such a policy, they would not have been allowed to do so. That Article 7, Paragraph 1 of the General Provisions of the Transition Treaty, signed on 26 May 1952, between the USA, Great Britain, France, and the Federal Republic of Germany, unmistakably stated, quote, all judgments and decisions in criminal matters heretofore or hereafter rendered in Germany by any tribunal or judicial authority of the three powers or any of them, or that is any of them, any one of them, shall remain final and valid for all purposes under German law and shall be treated as such by German courts and authorities. So it, and this was signed, you know, by the, by Adenauer and his government, because that was the only way that they could form a German government and have a legislature and have, you know, run their own country. But they weren't really free to run their own country however they wanted, because the authority of these three powers and what they had come to, the decisions that they had come to, meaning at Nuremberg, that tribunal there, remained final and valid under German law, and it has to remain that way. So so he goes on, so the courts and authorities of the nominally independent Federal Republic of Germany were explicitly forbidden to revise the sentences pronounced against German politicians and soldiers by the three Western powers. That is, whatever was desired in these trials had to be allowed to happen, and they couldn't, even if German politicians wanted to intervene and do something, they couldn't do it, because this whole agreement puts you still in a state of war if you do not follow these rules that you're given here about what your law is going to be. And if you don't, well then, these three powers can come in, and certainly it would just be the United States anymore. Basically, the United States come in and, put a stop to it. Now, well, I don't know how that would work out, you know, in public relations today. But obviously, they've got people in there now who are so in agreement with them, and who are on the left wing type of, you know, most Germans belong to these left wing parties. Well, actually, a lot of them, maybe most belong to Merkel's party, but it's left too. So you know, they don't want to change it. They don't, and they don't allow anything to take place that would change this mentality of Germany, that would bring anybody who's not on the left to a place of power. Just as an example is what has happened in Greece with the Golden Dawn Party. As soon as that party, and you know, they don't have the law, they're supposed to be a sovereign nation, but as soon as the that party started looking too strong, they came in and dealt with it. And that's what they're doing now, and they're not going to allow it. That's all of Europe, because all of Europe now is under the same, really the same rules and forces that Germany started out to be Germany. But that's what the European Union is. So incidentally, Groff says the last executions of German officers were carried out by the American occupiers on German soil as late as 1951, 2 years after the foundation of the Federal Republic in 1949, that thing I was just reading you about. And no truly sovereign nation, he says, would have tolerated this. Well, I'm not sure about that today, but the German ruling class needs the Holocaust more than anything else for its own survival. It needs it to nip in the bud any kind of resurgence of German self-esteem, to block the rise of any national forces and ideas, and hence to remain in power. So that again gives some good background on why this Holocaust is such a big deal and why it's so protected by so many people in the world today, and why it is so difficult. I don't want to be negative right in the beginning, but you know, we can prove without a shadow of a doubt that these things didn't happen. But the powers that be are not going to allow the people to get that information and to change their own minds about it. Now, that's why I say that the only thing we can do, besides do the work that like these three men are doing to continue to put out the facts and to disprove the lies, that what we can do is to try to get as many people to listen to this. And if we got enough people to change their mind about it and to see that it was a big lie and to understand why and what's behind it, then once you got a large enough number of people, you could start to make an impact with it. So that's why we need to do the best job that we can. And sometimes that takes a little restraint. I know that's true, in order to reach people. So, but, all right, well, I won't go into that again. Now, the Fuhrer Order on page, it starts on page 229, this thing I've got. No, this is chapter 6 I've got here, the Fuhrer Order, page 229. I don't know, the war economy. I've got a little, some notes on this. It's because it brings up Wendy Lauer. That's the author of that book, Hitler's Furies, that I talked about a couple weeks ago, on a program. I don't remember which one, but she's a respected, supposedly kind of respected historian whose total specialty is Holocaust, though. So that's not very respectable, but. She's mentioned in here as being the author of a book that was a quotation was taken from, and so therefore, you know, it's like all of these historians, while their books that are quoted by the Holocaust workers, like these five bloggers. And we're talking right now about Jonathan Harrison, one of the five who's done the work of going after Carlo Mattonio in their paper. And so Carlo Mattonio is responding to him for the most part. But he's using, they use quotes, but you have to really examine them. And the point of this, and I'm not going to read all of it, but the point of it is that Mattonio is pointing out how Jonathan Harrison takes his quotes and then the footnote too from somebody else's book. And sometimes it's from a book, but often it's from a document, you know, a document that was presented at Nuremberg, a German document from that time period, from the war time period. And He uses that. He'll give a sentence or two, or maybe a little bit more, as a quotation to prove his point, and then he'll have it as a footnote, and he'll have that document down there. And the fact is that Mattonio has seen again and again and again that he has lifted this stuff straight from somebody's book. For example, he lifted some from this book by Wendy Lauer, where later, a little bit further down, he quotes something and then he gives the footnote that she gave for it, meaning that he has never seen it himself. This is why he calls them plagiarists and cut and paste bloggers, because he doesn't go and find these documents and look over these documents himself, make sure what they say. He doesn't translate any of it himself. He doesn't, to make sure that the translation is correct. See, Mattonio does all of this. He is extremely thorough. He knows all the documents. And if he doesn't, he goes and finds it. And he knows how to do that because he knows languages. But this Harrison, who's trying to, you know, accuse him of doing a poor job of his revisionism, all he does, over and over again, what he's doing is he's they go, he's mostly using two books, Christian Gerlach, and the other one is, oh, it's right, I forget the book. The other, oh well, it'll come to me in a minute. He's using these books by these two, Christopher Browning, Christopher Browning's pretty prolific, and don't let his name fool you that it's a, you know, sounds like a nice name, but he's a very bad, Holocaust exterminationist writer, and so is Gerlach, I guess, and they, he just goes through their books and copies what they've said, and he uses their footnotes and puts them as his, and therefore he makes some mistakes sometimes, and they've made mistakes. And then, he makes the same mistake because he doesn't recognize any of it. And Mottonio calls him on this again and again. So knowing that, I might mention a few of them, but I won't continue to mention all those. And then on page, that's all I'll say about that. On page 263, there's something about gas vans. And Bob, the gas vans section is pretty short, I think because there's not anything to them. Harrison didn't say too much about it, because the way they've organized their book, our three revisionists, is that they've simply gone from front to back of the blogger's book or paper and answered it. You know, basically, they've basically used the same, timetable, you might say, or way of organizing it. So, if they don't say much about gas vans, then they don't have to have much to answer. But Harrison writes, the eventual use of gas vans in the Minsk-Mogilev area was confirmed by Einsatzkommando 8 driver Joseph Wendel in court testimony in 1970. While Sergei Romanov of Holocaust Controversies has published a document cited by Gerlach showing the arrival of two gas vans called Gaswagenin, in the original, in Smolensk, again, Russia, basically, or Ukraine, in February 1942. And Matonia writes, from a historiographic point of view, a simple testimony, even more so one dating from the year 1970, has no value at all. He's talking about that they are using some testimony in a trial in 1970 by this person named Joseph Wendel, saying that he knew of the arrival of these two gas vans in Smolensk. And, you know, and that's just hearsay, basically. And Mertonio is saying that has no value at all. And he says, regard to this particular document, I have demonstrated in my own study, and he gives the name of it, that one of the two gas vans assigned to Einsatzkommando 8, the Sauer truck with the number plate POL71462, which was later sent to Auschwitz at the beginning of September 1944, was for certain a generator gas-fueled vehicle. That is, you know, one of those generator gas vans. And it was simply a gas wagon that was used simply as a short form of generator gas wagon. And I believe what he's saying is that if it's a generator gas van, it couldn't have been used for the purpose that they say it was to gas people inside of it. And Matonia says it stands to reason that the second gas van of the Einsatzkommando also, that another Sauer truck, S-A-U-R-E-R, Sauer truck, this one with the license plate POL71457, very close license plates, but not the same, was of the same kind. So you see how, you know, it's just, this is the way this book goes. I mean, they just debunk what these bloggers are saying as trying to show proof of things that, you know, of what they say happened. Then the court, Harrison quotes, court proceedings have also uncovered that around the end of May 1942, Einsatz Commando 8 received a gas van from Smolensk. The driver was SS Hauptsturmfuhrer would be SCH. The name is not spelled out. It's just SCH period. Who belonged to the driver's staff of the Einsatzkommando. And Matonio responds to this as saying, as I explained before, the court proceedings can uncover what they please, but without documents, their findings have limited historiographical value. So now, there's something else here I'm going to skip. I'm going to go on to the Kohair report, my last thing on my notes here. Page 413, there is within this chapter that I'm at the very end of this chapter that I'm going to be talking about when I, as soon as I get to it, chapter 5. The very end of it, it talks about this Kohair report. And this is well known, and it become very important because it's the one now that they say proves, and David Irving is one who is agreeing with the Kohair report that it's reliable, that all of these over a million Jews, whatever, were sent to these camps, or they were transported anyway, and then there's no record of where they went after that. So that shows that they were exterminated in these camps. I don't know which one this might have been from the Kohair report. Well, they went to a lot of places from in his report. But these extermination camps. So, so-called. Excuse me, I'm having a little throat stuff. It's Harrison quotes this. In early 1943, the progress of the final solution was documented by Richard Kohair. However, it is known that the original version of the Kohair report did not use the term sifted through, but had instead referred to Sonderbehandlung, which means special treatment. You've all heard about the special treatment thing. So Himmler's assistant, Brandt, had written to Kohair and stated that the Reichsfuhrer SS has received your report on the final solution of the European Jewish question. He wishes that special treatment of the Jews not be mentioned anywhere. That's the quote from Brandt. It goes on, the term special treatment, therefore, according to Harrison, clearly had a sinister meaning. The Kohair report's history, therefore, reveals not only the scope of the final solution, but also its true purpose, which was extermination. Now, Matonio says, Harrison did not even bother to discuss my detailed analysis of the Kohair report. This is indeed a very peculiar method of confutation. Sometimes they're very funny. I will therefore restate what I wrote in this regard, beginning with a quotation from Witte and Tyus. Now, this next I'm going to read is taken from Witte and Tyus, who are not on our side, or on the side of Matonio's understanding. So they had written Kohair's original wording of page 9.4, to which Himmler objected, is not fully known. That is the original wording, because they don't have the original. Only the corrected version is extant. Kohair must have been too explicit, leaving little doubt that he meant the killing. Otherwise, Himmler's objections to the widely familiar term Sonderbehandlung in a state secret document could not be explained. Kohair changed page 9 of the report as requested. when he sent the corrected version back to Himmler's office on April 28th, it apparently escaped the Reichsfuhrer's notice that the objectionable term Sonderbehandlung remained on page 10. Well, this is kind of odd right here, I'll just say myself, that if Himmler's office wrote to him and told him to remove that word Sonderbehandlung, not to use it, a special treatment. And then when the document came back to them, corrected, it was still there. You'd think that they would have noticed it, but supposedly these people say they must not have noticed it. They go on, the supposition this isn't as big as it usually is, but I think this is Metonio. The supposition proffered by Witte and Tyus does not make sense. If Corhair, on page 9, item 4 of his report, had really been too explicit in his hint at an alleged killing of the Jews, Himmler would have ordered him to modify this wording, change his wording. Instead, he ordered him not to use the words special treatment of Jews, which means that in connection with the letter of April 10th, 1943, mentioned above, the expression special treatment of Jews did in fact appear on page 9, item 4 of the report. This is confirmed by the sum total, which appears at the end of the item 5 of Corhair's report, where it is said, evacuation total, including Theresienstadt and including special treatment. So special treatment was not removed, and they made a big deal, the Holocausters, of saying, they were calling it special treatment, and then in this one case, Himmler got worried, and told this Corhair not to use that word anymore. And yet when it's examined by someone like Carlo Metonio, who doesn't let anything get by him, I don't know anyone who's as thorough, and as I've already said, as he is. And he's so prolific too. He must, he just works on this stuff all the time, I guess. Anyway, he's showing that this is not the way it was. And there was there's a whole list of numbers. There's the total is supposed to be 1,873,500 Jews. And then there's one of the numbers is almost as much as that. It's 1,500,000 and a little more Jews. Or this is called not Jews, but transports / pass through equals special treatment. So these are the special treatment people. Some of them. Well, this is they were allowed to be passed through. I don't know if I'm totally wrong here because I'm only got this little part here. These are the ones that went on through onto Russia. The ones that they say didn't go on through but were stopped at these camps and exterminated. I can't say for sure, but there's a whole lot of them listed here. Most of them are, the number for Auschwitz is mentioned here twice. 159,500 deportees to Auschwitz. And then there's some broken down numbers in there. And then on another place, 45,500 approximately deportees to, of which 8,500 went to Auschwitz, and so many were selected for work, and so on. Now, but Metonio writes about this, if it helps us any, without further going into detail, it results already from these figures that in the Corhair report on the special treatment, at least 423,857 deportees are missing, of which 129,000 were sent to Auschwitz, and of those, 56,000 were selected for work. So he says, if therefore special treatment had been a cryptonym, meaning killing, then the Corhair report would prove that in Auschwitz no killing of Jews was performed. I see what he's saying now. And that the 72,873 non-registered Jews were not gassed, I leave it to Harrison's imagination to provide an alternative answer. So, you know, if Auschwitz was the main gassing place, the only ones that were sent there was a small number, and they account for all those. So he had said somewhere else that there were no prisoners at Auschwitz that were not registered. There were no non-registered prisoners. They were all registered, and they're all listed too. So there weren't all these millions that went there and somehow got exterminated. Well, it continues. It should also be apparent from the Corhair report and other documents so far discussed in this chapter that the final solution was being fully implemented during the war. Well, another argument that the bloggers are trying to make, and other Holocaust historians, there's lots of they take it from a lot of their work. They want to show that the final solution was being implemented during the war, because they need to show that all these Jews, 6 million, were murdered during the war, before it was over. And Metonio and his allies hold that we're going to go into that in the next hour, that Hitler had made a clear decision that he wanted to put off the final solution until after the war, and in the meantime, all these Jews were to be moved to the east as much as possible. Of course, it was a huge undertaking. There wasn't enough time. It wasn't all done, but I'm going to have more to say about the good job that they did, I hope, in the next hour. So enjoy the break music, ladies and gentlemen, and we'll be back in 5 minutes.
Keiner, der an dich denkt, nur eine einzige Zahl erinnert an deine Qual. Keiner kommt mehr hierher, niemand vermisst dich mehr. Oh, es tut weh, wenn ich deinen Stein so sehe. Treuer Soldat, mehr als ein namenloses Grab. Ich höre die Stimme, ich höre zum Gespräch. Du Kamera, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich schwöre dir, so wahr ich hier stehe, ich trage die Fahne, wohin ich auch gehe. Nie werde ich euch verraten. Für kein Geld der Welt, ich kämpfe für dich, ungebrochener Held. Ich kämpfe für dich, unbekannter Held. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, ich gedanke zu mir sprich. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht,
egal was geschieht,
wir werden bei euch sein. Und wer dann auch lügt, euer Namen benutzt, eure Heldentaten durch Geld hier beschmutzt, den trifft das Schwert von unsichtbarer Hand, ein Totenwächter. Von Wotan gesandt, ein Totenwächter im schwarzen Gewand. Doch ich höre eine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Bis an der Zeit, übernimmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Kamera, du siehst, wir stehen für euch ein, die Kraft, die wir brauchen, wird uns Wotan verleihen. Ihr gabt so viel für dieses Land, es war der Glaube, der euch verband, es war der Glaube. Der euch verbannt. deine Stimme. Ich stoppe zum Gespräch. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimmt im Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Und kehre ich einst an deinen Stein zurück, berichte ich dir von unserem Glück. Dann ist es geschafft und wir sind wieder frei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, darum ging's mir dabei. Dein Grab blüht wieder, denn jetzt sind wir frei. Doch ich höre deine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben und bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Nun ist an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Eid. Nimm dem Geiste die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein. Ich höre eine Stimme, die sanft zu mir spricht. Du Kamerad, bitte verrat uns nicht. Wir haben alles gegeben, bezahlt mit unserem Leben. Und bis an der Zeit, übernehmt unseren Halt. Wir sind Geiste, die Waffen, ich weiß, ihr werdet schaffen. Und habt keine Angst, ihr seid nicht allein. Egal was geschieht, wir werden bei euch sein.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And this is Carolyn Yeager on Saturday Afternoon with Carolyn. And I'm back to the very excellent revisionist book by Carla Mantegna, Jürgen Graf, and Thomas Kues that has come out couple of weeks ago, and I've been talking about it, and I'm now at chapter 5, and I on the PDF, and I have to be very careful not to touch that little slider bar and the little slider marker in the middle, because this is such a long thing, you know, 1,500 pages, so that if you move that even slightly, it goes, you know, shoots up or down 100 or 200 pages or more, and then I have to find my place again. So, but I'm at the beginning on page 174. Its title is The Fuhrer Order and the Alleged NS, National Socialist Extermination Policy. And this is written by Carla Mantegna, as I said before. And I'm just going to read this, start reading, because it's very interesting right from the start, and then I'll skip around some. In the second chapter of our opponent's work, dedicated to the development of Nazi policy, in quotes, Jonathan Harrison contests my approach regarding the existence of a so-called Fuhrer order for the alleged extermination of the European Jews, arguing that the most recent Orthodox Holocaust historiography has arrived at the idea of an incremental process with a number of acceleratory spurts between summer 1941 and summer 1942. As a consequence, according to Harrison, he writes, Mantegna is deeply unhappy that many historians no longer rely upon a single Hitler order, so he pretends that all such historiography borders on parapsychology. Leaving aside the fact that parapsychology was indeed evoked by the Dean of Holocaust Studies, Raoul Hilberg, who spoke in this regard of an incredible meeting of minds, a consensus mind reading by a far-flung bureaucracy, the merit of my portrayal consists in the fact that it captures the embarrassing efforts, first by various military courts and later by Orthodox Holocaust historians, to sort out and clarify this delicate matter. The exterminationist history of the elusive Fuhrer order is a dense net of unfounded speculations and misinterpretations of documents in which subsequent historians denounce the errors and unfounded claims of their predecessors, only to have their own missteps denounced in turn. The most recent developments in this saga are based on the magic word radicalization, a lexical subterfuge which has merely served to exacerbate the issue even further. These developments ultimately show only the desperate stubbornness of true believer historians, forced to cudgel their brains and twist the documentary record in search of a solution to an unsolvable problem. From the historiographical point of view, the thesis of progressive radicalization, quote unquote, might explain how and why the hypothetical decision and the hypothetical order for mass extermination would have been arrived at, but it can in no way substitute for the decision and the order themselves. Indeed, precisely the person who has contributed most to the development of the thesis, Christian Gerlach, has himself proven unable to renounce belief in a Führer order, to which he simply assigns a different date. Quote, he writes, "In my opinion, Hitler made this decision in early December 1941. The question on, Matonio continues, the question as a whole will be explored in detail in the pages to follow. Since the plagiarist bloggers repeatedly set against our position the shootings of Jews, especially in the Eastern territories, it is imperative to assert right away an important distinction. To illustrate, we can start with three statements by prominent mainstream Holocaust historians. In summarizing the position of the earlier Orthodox historiography on the timing of key decisions, Gerlach declares, "At most, it is assumed that there were two separate decisions. One involving the execution of Soviet Jews would have occurred in July or August of 1941. The second decision, concerning the extermination of Jews from the rest of Europe, is supposed to have been reached in September or October of that year." Matonio, regarding the decision concerning the Soviet Jews in particular, Christopher Browning has written. So he's giving the views of three different Holocaust historians, first Gerlach, now Browning. Browning wrote, "However, the Jewish policy of the Nazis in the rest of Europe was not changed immediately. One continued to speak about emigration, expulsions, and plans for a future resettlement. The idea of the final solution for the European Jews was formed by a separate process and resulted from a different decision." And then Dieter Pohl also confirms this same view. He wrote, oh my God, where did I go? Oh, I moved a little bit too far. Moved. It's so easy to do that on here. Okay, here I am. I just went from one page to another and it jumped. Well, you see, and you know, he's got the one thing that Matonio does, they all do. They've got the original language, in this case it's German, and then they've got the English translation, so that if, you know, they make sure of the translation, so that you can see how it's been translated. This is very important if you're doing this kind of work. You know, you don't hide anything. You don't just try to slide by and slough by with sloppy stuff. So this Dieter Pohl wrote, "Although presumably at the same time, the end of July, beginning of August," they're talking about 1941. This is when it had to happen, see, because after the invasion of the Soviet Union, then they had, that's when they had to have their plan to do all this, because that's, it was that after that that they started coming up with all the atrocity stories and the idea of Jews being murdered. So this is when the order would have had to come about, at sometime around this time. And so he's, Pohl is saying that it was at July, end of July, beginning of August, instruction was given to the Einsatzgruppen in the Soviet Union to shoot Jewish children and women en masse as well. The plan for the complete murder of all European Jews was not yet predetermined through this. They just started out and then just kept growing. That's the idea of the radicalization. They just kept getting more radical. So Carlo Mottogna writes, Mutatis mutandis, Latin. This is in fact our own position, namely that the treatment of the Soviet Jews constitutes an issue quite separate from that of the policy applied to other European Jews. In order to prove the contrary, our plagiarist bloggers would have to demonstrate, one, that there existed an institutional order from Hitler, Himmler, or Heydrich to execute the Soviet Jews. Two, that the hypothetical order stipulated that these Jews were to be exterminated for being Jews and not as carriers of Bolshevism. Three, that accordingly every single documented massacre was carried out against the Jews for being Jews and not for other contingent reasons, war reprisals, battle against partisans, etc. Moreover, with regard to the non-Soviet European Jews, the plagiarist bloggers would also have to prove, four, that there existed an institutional order or regional orders to exterminate Jews for being Jews, five, that every single documented shooting of Western Jews, if claimed to be pursuant to an extermination policy, was performed against Jews for being Jews and not for other contingent reasons. Six, that extermination camps were indeed built at Birkenau, Majdanek, Chelmno, Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka. And seven, that millions of Jews were killed in gas chambers there in those camps. To confront us with a long list of shootings without answering these questions in a convincing way does not solve anything, since as a matter of principle, we do not have any difficulty in admitting the reality of mass shootings, and since, more importantly, such shootings do not themselves prove the existence of an order or a systematic plan to exterminate the Jews. So you can see how he's going about this. His main goal is and always has been, since he was convinced himself, is to show that there was no plan and therefore there were no places to carry out this plan in so-called, you know, camps with gas chambers and so on. Otherwise, you've got a war situation that you can always talk about, you know, but he goes on, with these premises stated, I cannot proceed to Harrison's criticism of our work. He starts his detailed exposition with a section entitled Extermination of Soviet Jews, June 1941, March 1942. Since I have already dealt with this issue in general terms in chapter 2 above, I will dispense with an overview here and move directly to the consideration of specific arguments. With regard to the question of the Einsatzgruppen, however, Graf Kues and I are currently preparing a specific study on the subject, so in its case, I will limit myself to simple statements of a general character, though still dissecting Harrison's individual arguments and sources. So, as we know, as he's saying, they're already working on this Einsatzgruppen book. Hooray. And there's not a big specific chapter here, but it comes up all the time. So there's a lot relating to it in this chapter. But the first section is very interesting, one of the most interesting, and I'm going to read the first part of it, not all of it, but the first part of it, and it is 5.1, the alleged National Socialist policy of mass starvation of Eastern populations. And he begins, Harrison begins his section on the extermination of Soviet Jews with these words. This is Harrison. During the planning stages for Operation Barbarossa, Nazi food policy was linked to plans for large-scale political killings. Mottogna says, he then adduces a list of documents, which he, Mottogna, is going to examine one by one. So the first document from Harrison is on May, the information taken from it is supposed to be condemned the Nazis. On May 2nd, 1941, a conference of state secretaries chaired by Thomas had concluded that umpteen million people will doubtless starve to death if we extract everything necessary for us from the country. And Matonio says the source of this is a file note reporting conclusions of today's deputy minister's meeting concerning Barbarossa. Dated 2nd May, 1941, the document states in part, you know, at first I thought, well, why would the deputy ministers of in the Third Reich be having a meeting about Barbarossa, even if it was secret, but make a file of it in May when it wasn't going to take place until the end of June. At least that was the final date for it. And it was so top secret. You know, I thought that seemed kind of strange, but Matonio doesn't seem to think so. So he continues, dealing with it and with the content of it. And he says that in this document by these, now remember these were some deputy ministers, German, having a meeting in May, planning type meeting. And they say the war can only be, two things they said in here, it's just two things taken from this. The war can only be continued if the entire Wehrmacht is nourished from supplies out of Russia in the third year of the war. That means by the third year, the Wehrmacht is going to have to depend totally, exclusively on food out that is right there in Russia, not sent in from the homeland. And two, in connection with this, umpteen millions of people will without doubt starve if what is required by us is taken out of the country. So, you know, they're talking about the contingencies, you see. They're talking about what might happen, you know, like they should be doing. You know, when we go in there and do this, what are going to be the situation we're going to face and so on. As Matonio says, this is no plan for large-scale political killing, but an assessment of the hypothetical if consequences of measures taken to secure the nourishment of the army, as results yet more clearly from point three of the memo. And point three says, the harvesting and hauling off of oil seeds and oil cake is the most important task. Only thereafter comes grain. The available fats and meat will presumably be consumed by the troops. Again, they're in a planning. They're just talking about it. Now these are the kind of things you see that these Holocausters will use as fact, as saying, well, they decided that they were going to starve the people, and because they were going to take all the food for themselves. When it actually was just a discussion about the situations as it would be happening there, and they have to look at the worst case scenario when they do that, you know, so they can be prepared. Anyway, the second document from Harrison is, he takes this quote, the selection of these starvation victims would follow a political economy of racial value, but would also be shaped by a political, ideological, racial belief that the enemy was the Jewish Marxist. And source for this that Harrison produces is the Alemanna instruction, here's in English, general instructions for all Reich commissars in the occupied Eastern territories issued by Alfred Rosenberg on 8th May 1941. This is before the invasion took place. And it could be he's talking about, the occupied Eastern territories at the time. And this was introduced at Nuremberg. This document has a number. And another part of it is the coming fight will be a fight for the food supply and raw materials for the German Reich, as well as for Europe as a whole, a fight ideological in nature in which the last Jewish Marxist enemy has to be defeated. Matonio says the premise of this statement was a plan to restructure the Eastern countries then under Soviet domination, described as follows on the previous page of the document. On the previous page of the document, it had said, "What this great Eastern task is essentially about is to establish great new state entities of altogether about 70 million inhabitants and to return another state entity, Russia, to its own original living space." Well, they wanted to move Russia to the east, and I'm not sure what its original living space was, but anyway, that's what it's saying. And Petonia says, Rosenberg describes this task as gigantic and then concludes with the following remark, from which Harrison adduces his linkage between National Socialist racial policy and the regime's alleged starvation plan. You know, they're going to starve the Soviets, the Russians, because they're Slavs, you know, because they're racially inferior, and so they're going to starve them. That's the point that Harrison is trying to make. But this Rosenberg report continues, "This coming battle is a battle for the nourishment and supply of raw materials, both for the German Reich and for the whole European area, a battle of world ideological nature in which the last Jewish Marxist enemy has to be wrestled to the ground, a state political war which entails a new concept of the state and by which Europe proper is advanced to the east in a decisive manner." You know, these people, these Germans, were taking this very seriously, and they had some top-notch people. When I think, you know, I continued on through this whole chapter, which I thought was never going to end. all the documents in which statements are made and so on, and they're all these National Socialists are communicating with one another. We come up with we're going to come up with Goering, of course Himmler, Heydrich, lots of now here we just had Rosenberg, but lots of slightly lesser officials ranks, but not that slight. I mean, still important people running this thing, and the things they were saying, what they were writing, how they were talking about it. I was so impressed by it. I'm so impressed by it because, of course, I'm not against what they were trying to do. That's one reason. But they were thinking everything through. They weren't bumbling around. They weren't completely lost on what they were facing and so on. But they really believed in this huge undertaking that they thought they had, and they did. They had to defeat the Bolshevist Jew, both the Bolshevism and Judaism, and get it out of Europe, not allow it into Europe. That was the whole deal there. You know, it really wasn't about, you know, they weren't against the Slavic people. They just knew that the Slavic people weren't going to accomplish this. So, you know, they were setting themselves out to do it. And I hope I can get to some of these very good things that back me up here. But so Matonia says, "Thus we find here no plan to starve a population." These are the things that Harrison offered. "The importance of the upcoming war with regard to nourishment and supply of raw materials for both Germany and Europe as a whole is indeed emphasized, as is the importance of ideology. But contrary to what Harrison would have his readers believe, this is envisioned not as a matter of a political economy of racial value for the selection of starvation victims, but rather as a part of an ambitious project aimed at restructuring the balance of power in Eastern Europe, that this project involved the appropriation of land by the German Reich and in some cases the resettlement of local populations is openly acknowledged. But not only does Rosenberg say nothing of deliberately starving those people, he in fact explicitly refers to the need to make plans for their compensation and reimbursement in view of, quote, achieving a just settlement." Just. So now number three, move on from there to the third document that Harrison offers. He quotes a brief excerpt from Nuremberg document, Economic Policy Directives for Economic Organization East, Agricultural Group, which which put this out in May 1941, before the invasion, 23rd May 1941, with the view to underscoring the specific demographic consequences anticipated in this planning. And this document says, there is no German interest in maintaining the productive capacity of these regions, also in what concerns the supplies of the troops stationed there. And then there's, you know, there's something left out. And then it goes on, the population of these regions, especially the population of the cities, will have to anticipate a famine of the greatest dimensions. The issue will be to redirect the population to the Siberian areas. As railway transportation is out of the question, this problem will also be an extremely difficult one. Matonio says, this document, of course, does contain chilling remarks on the prospective death by starvation of millions of people. Indeed, in that sense, Harrison might have found even more striking passages in it to quote from, rather than evidence for the notion that death was at the forefront of Nazi intentions for the Soviet population, with Jews at the front of the queue, which is how Harrison interprets the meaning of all this. Matonio says, what in fact emerges from a reading of the full document is something quite different. And, you know, when they're talking about that land, you know, they're talking about not the best agricultural land, too. They're talking, and I think I should, maybe here I should add, if you haven't already thought about that, that as the Germans were advancing, of course, this was written before that, but, you know, as they would be advancing, and, well, when it did happen, as the Germans advanced, Stalin put out the scorched earth policy, and they were all ordered, and there are lots of political operatives and commissars and so on in amongst the Red Army troops that were retreating and amongst the people, and they were, you know, making sure that everything was destroyed. I mean, they destroyed all the farm equipment. They burned down the houses, so they wouldn't have any houses to stay in, Germans. They took all the stored grains and hogs and cattle and so whatever they had there with them that they could and whatnot. They let loose and, you know, drove them off into the wilderness so they wouldn't be there for the Germans. And that meant the people who stayed, a lot of the Russian people, including, of course, lots of the Jews, followed the troops east, but they didn't all. And so the people left behind were happy to see the Germans come, actually. But, you know, everything had been destroyed, and they had no interest in seeing that this became a food supply area again. It was because it wasn't that good a one to begin with, and they weren't, you know, there was no way they didn't have the ability to get that going again. They did try, and actually, when they did get there, they did do better than they thought they might, actually. And we're going to come to that. So, but you can see the difficulties, and they probably anticipated that also when they were writing this stuff. Now, here's the long passage from this document. This is the economic department of the Reich, writing this report. From all this, it results that the German administration in this area might well strive to mitigate the consequences of the certainly impending famine and to accelerate the naturalization process. One might strive to cultivate these areas more intensively in terms of an increase of the area cultivated with potatoes. That is, you know, plant potatoes there. Germans are good at planting potatoes. And other high-yielding crops important for consumption. Famine in this region cannot, however, be avoided thereby. Many tens of millions of people in this area will be superfluous and will have to die or migrate to Siberia. Attempts to save the population there from famine by using the surplus production from the Black Earth Zone. Now, I think that would be the really rich, fertile ground, and a lot of that was in Ukraine, and probably other places too. So, but they're saying they couldn't send that to them because it would only be at the expense of provisioning Europe, and they were using this for Europe too, you know, to feed Europe. So they undermined Germany's chances of perseverance in the war to these people who are going to need, you know, who are going to be experiencing this famine, this overload of Russians there with no way of providing for themselves. But to do something for them would undermine Germany's chances of perseverance in the war. They undermine Germany's and Europe's ability to endure the blockade. The manufacturing industry of Belgium and France is far more important to Germany and the German war effort than that of Russia. It is thus much more important to secure the nutritional needs of those areas where manufacturing is going on that they need, with surpluses from the East, than to seek out of ambition to preserve Russian industry in the Soviet consumption zone. That is, to keep people working in Russia, where they have some industry too, but, you know, how to feed them so that they can work is the problem, and they have to make these choices. They thought they would. This is still preliminary. The guideline in all things must be no dispersion of resources on dependencies, but resolution of the main task, relief of the food situation of Greater Germany. Oh, that's it, you know. Take care of yourself first. In other words, what was at the forefront, Petonio writes, of NS intentions in May 1941, at least as reflected in the economic policy directives text, was relieving the critical food supply situation in Germany and Western Europe in order to enable the Reich to withstand the kind of starvation blockade with which the Allies had brought Germany to its knees in the First World War. The calculations are coolly made and with little regard to the human suffering they imply, but they by no means aim at death for its own sake for the Soviet population, let alone for Jews. Indeed, Harrison's attempt to link this document with the final solution is a prime example that, you know, of just how tenuous the connections posited by Orthodox Holocaust historiography can be. The document itself, of course, makes no mention of Jews, but Harrison picks up on the term überflüssig, which means superfluous, apparently, as it appears in the passage quoted above, and twice tries to twist it to fit. He says the document, Harrison says, the document tellingly referred to these groups as useless eaters, a phrase originally used to justify killing the mentally ill in the T4 program, that is that euthanasia program they always bring up, thereby confirming that euthanasia terminology had spread to these planners. Superfluous means useless eaters. Well, in a sense it is, because they're not able to produce anything. And when you're in the situation, in that war situation, you know, you have to look at, everything has to be productive. That's just the way it is. I mean, you know, there's no way to think that these people should have been treated with hugs and kisses. You know, it's just not done that way. War is war. And if you want to say, I don't want to really get into this, but, you know, I say, well, but the Germans invaded the Russians, and that's that Russian propaganda, you know, that they, you know, they were just innocent, peaceful citizens there. No, they are planning to invade Germany and then all of Europe, and that's as clear as day. So continuing, Montoni makes another connection and continues to speak on this. He says, curiously, the term superfluous eaters really does appear later in the document, but it seems unlikely that Harrison has this passage in mind in his dark speculations about euthanasia terminology. And a part of this document that he was referring to later, it says, according to reports out of Russia, around 25% of the total workforce in the collective farms, see, they weren't there yet, is occupied with management. That is, they are sterile bureaucracy. It will thus be essential to supply practical work for all superfluous eaters. They're talking about these bureaucrats, you know, all these managers. You know, Soviet Union was top-heavy with management and managers. Under all circumstances, the ensuring of production must come first. So, let's see. So he says, Harrison continues, this is further confirmed by a document by Engelhardt, which included a table of nationalities by town and country in Byelorussia. Oh, you know, this is a real interesting thing, but I don't think I have time to go into it. It's just, I'll try to describe it real quick. There's a report, again, by one of these, Engelhardt. It's by Engelhardt. It's a table of nationalities. You know, it's Waldemar von Politica had underlined, had gone through it and had underlined some things and added marginal notes saying things like starve and then it's like this report is talking about the food situation. I was talking about, well, this is pretty interesting here. I'm just skipping down because there's a lot of stuff here about the document. But this, I'm going to pass this too. He's pointing out Jonathan Harrison's failings. Where is this part? Boy, you really go a long way. Okay, in Engelhardt's report, this is a German guy. He sent in a report about, you know, what how to handle all this stuff in Russia. And here he says, out of every three agrarian families, certainly two can release one worker each between 16 and 40 years old of both genders to the Reich for the most part as seasonal workers and for a smaller part as contracted farmhands. And then this writing in the margin business, whoever was doing it wrote, shall die in the margin. Like these people who are going to be sent to the Reich were going to die. Matonya says, why would these seasonal workers and farmhands, why were they supposed to die? And what would be the motivation behind the Germans, this supposedly Engelhardt who wrote this, why would he say, you know, that they needed these people as for work, but why would he say they were going to die there? It doesn't make any sense is what he's pointing out. But here's the thing that, you know, they so often want to say that, oh, they just took all these people, whole families, and dumped them, you know, forced them into slave labor. And then they talk about the ones who were sent to Germany to work and talk about them as slave labor and so on and how terrible it was, like, but how they separated families and so on. But here he's saying that only two out of three of these farm families could release, probably two out of three, because maybe it depends on how many children they have, how many are in the family that still need to be there to work the farm. And but they could manage to give one worker each, one worker per family from each family, from but not every family, between 16 and 40 years old, and they'd take either males or females to the Reich to help out the very need for this kind of workers, farm workers and so on in the Reich. In fact, in the labor service for the young people, the girls were often sent to farms to work as farm hands. So they might help in the house, but they could do light farm work and so on. And they had their whole year to do that. That's their, you know, their state service they had to do, and they had to work on somebody's farm. But they were supposed to do that cheerfully because, you know, that was helping They also were sent to large families with many children, you know, enough where their mother needed some help and to help with their children. And they, you know, just live with the family and so on. So this is the kind of thing a lot of these people were doing. And they probably had it better off in Germany doing this than they would have had in the Soviet Union at the time. But anyway, that is this story about the writing in the margin. Now, I think I've got the idea across here that they're trying to, make it seem like the National Socialists had a plan to starve the Russians, and along with shooting them and putting them, I guess they didn't put the Russians in gas chambers, in order to get rid of them. This is taken seriously by a lot of people you think wouldn't take it so seriously. I'm going to now move on to where am I? The reprisal policy. That's on page 207. So I have to jump ahead carefully to page 207. I went a little too far, but I'll go back. All right. The reprisal policy and the Jewish extermination. Harrison adds that the supposed context we ignore is systematically misrepresented by deniers who discuss reprisal policy. He then states, I need to find my white network page again. Okay. He then states, that Franz Stalecker, the leader of Einsatzgruppe A, became the source of a crucial local initiative and goes on to mention the shooting of 201 Jews in June 1941. He moreover states that Einsatzkommando E.K. Tilsit conducted similar killings, predominantly of Jews, in the nearby towns of Krottingen, 214 people, and in Pollangen, 111 people. And this is all supposed to, gonna be to add up, that these people who are putting a few things in their reports, that this means that there's an extermination of the Jews by shooting policy. Well, there was a lot of shooting going on, but there was a reason for it all. So Matonio says, we have no difficulty admitting that the German reprisal measures in the East, and not only there, were at times excessive and disproportionate, sometimes even performed with false pretenses. But this has nothing to do with the radicalization, which would have almost automatically led to a mass extermination of the Jews. now, I don't want to take up time to do it, but I don't really... I know that they will say that, but I wouldn't really call it, when it's reprisal, I really wouldn't call it excessive or disproportionate, because they're using an example of 10 to 1. And that's not at all. In fact, I would think 100 to 1 or even 1,000 to 1 wouldn't be excessive. When you're thinking about some of the things that were going on against the German soldiers and the sabotage and so on. I mean, I think reprisal measures have to be very strong in order to get across to the people not to do that, and or else you just get rid of them all by shooting them. So, but anyway, they're not concerned about that, because they say that reprisals are normal in warfare, and that even everybody is excessive with them at times, and even if they're excessive or disproportionate, that doesn't mean that it's an extermination policy. Far from it. And this disproportionate. What do they mean by proportionate? Like if you kill 10 of our German troops, mutilate them, then we're going to kill 10 of you. Well, that's not going to do anything. If you do an exact proportion. They can lose that many. So you have to go very disproportionate in order to make your point. Now, you know, Harrison is just pointing out that at one time, Heydrich and Himmler, right after the, on June 30th, shortly after the invasion, they approved a measure of the Einsatzkommando Tilsit for some reprisal killings that they did. They happened to be around that area, and they were given the report of it. They read it over, and they approved it and so on. And this is supposed to be damning. then we go on to, they've got, I don't want to read all of this. But here's where I was going to get in a little trouble trying to find where I wanted to go to. 263. Well, this is going on, and while I'm looking for this, Hattie came on the line. You want to say something, Hattie?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm looking. I'm going to look for my good part here. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Here are a lot of
Oops, you're breaking up.
Okay. I hear a lot of okay, well, let me see if I can just shut something off here.
Have I been sounding all right? Have I been coming through all right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm just going to shut something off here. But there. That should be a little better. All right. Yeah, I've done some research on that term, useless eater, because for some reason it pervades patriotard rhetoric. For example, there's some host on the Republic Broadcasting Network that uses this term, useless eater. They like to develop this weird propaganda about how the New World Order wants to kill off all the useless eaters, when that's probably the opposite of what they want to do. But they made a big hubbub about useless eaters at Nuremberg, you know, 1946-47. Mm-hmm. But the term useless eater was not invented by the National Socialists at all.
Well, that's right. I have that in here, actually.
It's a term from animal husbandry.
It was first used somewhere else in somebody's writings. Quite a few years before, like in early 1800s, and that's where it was picked up from.
And it's been used in English as well as French. It's mm-hmm. not a unique term to German, and certainly not unique to National Socialism. An example would be if you raise chickens, you really only need one rooster, right? So all the other roosters are useless eaters. I found that example from a book that's in English, mm-hmm. you know, from about 100 years ago. So.
Yeah, well, that's interesting because here's this part that I wanted to read, and it goes into this, and it's something written by Goring. I mean, it's a report, it's a document, which is a memorandum from July 16th, 1941, a discussion between Hitler, Rosenberg, Lammers, Keitel, and Goring regarding the German goals in the Soviet Union. This was right in July 41. The complete text of the first quotation is as follows. We will therefore again emphasize, now they don't say who is the writer of this, but Matonio later says he thinks it's Goring because he said Goring was known for his hyperbole sometimes. He says, we will therefore again emphasize that we were forced to occupy to, maybe they're talking about how to explain things to the rest of the world, to impose order and to secure a territory. In the interest of the local inhabitants, we have to ensure peace, food, transportation, etc. Hence our regulation. It should therefore not be seen that thereby a definitive regime starts to appear. All necessary measures, shooting, resettlement, etc., we are taking anyway and can take anyway. I probably missed out on some previous stuff I should have read. But then it says, talking about the deployment and equipment of police units, this gigantic territory must naturally be pacified as quickly as possible. This would best be done by shooting anyone who even looks sideways at us. Now, they made a big deal about this, you know, saying that in this meeting they were saying that they were going to shoot anyone who even looks sideways at us. But, yeah, I forgot that we're in reprisals now. We're not in the starvation thing. And so Matonio thinks that that was probably uttered by Goring, who tended to talk and kind of talk that way. And the shooting of those opposing the German occupation was thus seen as the best method to pacify the occupied Soviet territories as quickly as possible. That is not as an enduring policy, and it must be considered within the context of the struggle against the partisans, as described in the following passage from the same document describing the meeting of these high-level men. The Russians have issued an order for partisan warfare behind our front line. This partisan war, again, also has its advantage. It allows us to eradicate what opposes us. So Matonio just keeps explaining these various things that are said in these documents, plus the shootings that do take place, as normal, you know, normal of what would be going on, and certainly in no way showing that it is an extermination policy. And that's very true, don't you think, Hattie?
Oh, yeah.
Poke around some more here. Well, you know, there's so much here. You know, and to find that, then when I start looking, I can't even really recognize what I'm looking at. So,
you know, like here, the tendency toward strong language is really a very common German vice. You get that with Nietzsche, you know.
Well, that's right. And even anybody, when you're just talking among yourselves, you know, you put things in different language. He doesn't really mean that he's going to shoot everybody who looks sideways at him. They just mean that, you know, if people look like they're guilty or if they're not cooperating, they need to do something about it right away. Because, you know, if not, they're going to be in big trouble. And they were talking about right off the bat, you know, right from the beginning to get things, you know, set in the right way. But here's something talking about this radicalization. Another almost immediate radicalization, that's in quotes, is said to have resulted from the requisitions by the Wehrmacht of 6,500 tons of wheat in August 1941 from reserve stocks of 5,000 to 6,000 tons. This means that, in Goring's words, the Wehrmacht takes absolute precedence as consumer over the indigenous civil population. He had quoted that earlier. Goring had put out a, as being the Reichsmarshal, he had some responsibility for some of this. He had put out a statement to be read to the troops that they needed to understand. Oh, I remember what this was. I'm just going to say this from memory. They were telling them that they must not give cigarettes or bread or anything to enemy. They were handing out some of their own supplies to Russian prisoners of war, because these prisoners of war were in such bad shape, you know. But they felt pity for them, and they were, you know, good-naturedly giving them stuff that was their own. And they put out this really strict report telling them, you know, to stop doing that, that this, what they are getting is coming at great sacrifice from the people back home in Germany, and they are doing without, and then they have to transport it all the way at great difficulty into the interior, and they have to see that they get enough, and they have to keep their own strength up, and they are not to be handing out cigarettes or bread or anything of their own to any enemy. And the only people who they also had very strict things that the only Russians who were to be helped were those who were working for the Wehrmacht. You know, they put some, as many as they could, to work right there, you know, in doing things for themselves, for, you know, for the forces and so on. And so they tried very hard to feed them, you know, well enough so they could be strong enough. So everything was like, feed the people who will work and help us, and the last people to be given anything are those who are not helping us or don't want to help us or we can't depend on or whatever. So that was the rule, and people who think that that's cruel are just kind of stupid, aren't they?
Well, it was a very desperate situation, and you do have to make some hard decisions when you really got, you know, when you're really pressed to the wall.
Well, that's what they're always called. They're always called hard decisions. They had to make hard decisions, and they knew it. And, you know, it was hard. The Germans knew that it was hard for them to make hard decisions because they're basically a soft-hearted, sympathetic people. And so they always were talking about how they had to toughen themselves and stiffen themselves if they were going to carry this through and so on. Well, we've only got a few minutes left. I didn't even begin to cover everything that I had, but I knew I was going to run into this problem of finding it and then getting to the next chapter and so on, which I can get to the next chapter easily enough. Whoops. I'm trying to go to my table of contents again. So we have decimation by labor is another pretty good one. It's a long one, too. No, that's not that many pages. I've got the page number wrong. But it's, you know, another thing that, you know, they were trying to exterminate all these people through starvation, trying to exterminate them through the reprisals, and they were trying to exterminate them through working them to death, which also shows that their labor and their labor problems and the labor policy was to put as many people to work as possible who could work and would work. You know,
they should not die. They should continue working.
Yeah, and plus they didn't want people who were going to be sabotaging, so they had to kind of sift through them to get people who didn't have, you know, weren't strong enemies of theirs, or were a little more neutral, because you know, you can get those people. And then I talked a little about the gas vans, and then they had this Europe-wide final solution. Another thing they're trying to prove, which I kind of touched on that in the beginning, was that that the final solution was Europe-wide, and the Jews in the Soviet Union were a part of the Jews in the rest of Europe, and they that this was and also that they were trying to complete it right then during the war, which would have been,
you know, the final solution to the Jewish problem was supposed to be worldwide. But that goes hand in hand with the claim that Hitler was trying to conquer the entire world, which nobody could take seriously these days. So I guess now we're just going to say it was about Europe instead.
Well, you know, I'm gonna continue with this on Monday. I don't have any other idea to do, and I want to do more on it. So you might want to join me on Monday, and we'll continue on with this, ladies and gentlemen. Maybe a little bit more from this chapter, but there's other very good chapters I want to mention too, and just to do my best to show you basically what's in this book, and hope that some of you will go and start reading it for yourself. You can pick around and, you know, look around, and you'll find something that's of interest to you. Well, thanks, ladies and gentlemen, for listening, and thanks, Hadding, for coming on. And we'll see you. I guess I will see you on Monday. Good day.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.